Well, today we're going to look at a passage that is an example of a sandwich in Mark's Gospel. And Mark has quite a few of them, including this one in Mark chapter 5. Now, a sandwich in Mark's Gospel is where he begins a story, and then the story is interrupted by something, and then you get the rest of the story. So you have a slice, and then something in the middle, and then you get the other slice. And of course, in the case of a literal sandwich, you mainly describe what the sandwich is by what's in the middle. So a cheese sandwich is not so much defined by the bread, by the slices, but by the cheese in the middle. What distinguishes a cheese sandwich from an egg sandwich, it's not the bread, which can be rather diverse, but it's the stuff in the middle, whether it's cheese or egg. Now, in some ways, the account here of this double healing that we're going to look at today is really defined for us by what's in the middle, namely the healing of the woman with this hemorrhage for over 12 years. And right in the middle of the passage is Jesus' quotation, verse 30. Who touched my clothes? And it's that question which begins to shed light on the whole of this narrative. In verses 21 to 24, we are introduced to Jairus, the synagogue ruler, his daughter, and to Jairus' desperate plea for help. And then in verses 25 to 34 is the account of the healing of this woman with the hemorrhage. And then verses 35 to 43, we go back to Jairus and his daughter. And I just want to point out some of the similarities between the two accounts, because they are not accidental. They are carefully thought out by Mark, led by the Holy Spirit, so that we're forced to think about the connections. Both are stories of a female restored by Jesus' touch, a younger woman and a more mature woman. In both cases, the women are addressed by Jesus, either as daughter or by a similar affectionate term. Both the duration of the woman's illness and the age of the daughter are given as 12 years. And in both accounts, Jesus is scorned by his own disciples in verse 31, and then by people laughing at him in verse 40. And in both instances, Jesus came into contact with someone who is unclean. According to the ritual of the day, this hemorrhaging woman was unclean and shouldn't have been in the crowd at all. And by the ritual of the day, the young woman who is now dead is defiled too. To touch either of them would mean that you were unclean until you went through some ritual purification. But in both cases, it is not Jesus who becomes unclean, but it is Jesus who makes the unclean clean. Now, I think it will help our understanding if we follow through the entire narrative twice. Once rather slowly, and then secondly more rapidly, but each time from a slightly different perspective. First of all, highlighting two people of faith, and then secondly, highlighting two kinds of faith. So first of all, we have two people of faith. Verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. So here was Jesus on the west side of Galilee, having just crossed over from the east side. Now on the east side, there are more Gentiles, and on the west side, there are more Jews, and there are substantial crowds here. And verse 22, then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came. Now, synagogue rulers in the first century were not paid professional clergy. They presided over the synagogue. They had overall oversight, but the position was almost always a lay position. And their responsibilities included looking after the building, maintaining the scrolls and making sure they were in good repair, obtaining new ones if they were beginning to wear out, They made sure that on the Sabbath day there were readers to read the lectionary readings for that day, to ensure that there were people that were set to pray and to organise who was doing the preaching. That was their role. And such people were known for their propriety and their piety, and they were very influential. They were respected in the community, and they were often well-to-do. And yet this man approaches Jesus without any officiousness or any pomp or ceremony, because he's desperate. And you can feel the desperation, can't you, of a parent in anguish. Verse 22, when Jairus saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." And I'm sure every parent knows the anguish that this man felt. But there's also some measure of faith here too. He expects Jesus to come and to do something. And it simply states in verse 24, "So Jesus went with him." Jairus interrupted Jesus' public ministry for this very private and very urgent appeal. And one of the wonderful things about Jesus is that he is not merely just a public figure. He's always got time for individuals. And we should be very wary of public figures who are only concerned about the big crowds and have no time for individuals. Now, the situation here is urgent. Jesus really must get there quickly, because as the original indicates in verse 23, this little girl is at the point of death. There's not a moment to spare. And yet we find Jesus sparing it, precisely because there is another urgent situation with someone else. Verse 24, a large crowd followed and pressed around Jesus, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors, and she had spent all that she had. And yet, instead of getting better, she just grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him and in the crowd, and she touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." And immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was free from her suffering. And at once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, and he turned round in the crowds and he asked, Who was it that touched my clothes?" Now, can you put yourself in Jairus' position? He has interrupted Jesus, and Jesus is rushing off with him to his home. And now somebody interrupts Jesus again. What is Jesus supposed to say? "Sorry, I already have an emergency to deal with." What would you do? Jairus, I'm sure, is simultaneously wondering how Jesus is going to handle this woman, and probably is thinking, "Look, hurry up and get this over with, because I've got a little girl who's dying." And there's no doubt that Jesus is slowed up by this woman. And it's right after the account of this woman and her issue that the report comes along that Jairus' daughter has died. The woman has had this problem for 12 years. Surely she could have waited another 30 minutes. By making time for her, isn't Jesus jeopardizing Jairus' daughter? I mean, you can imagine the anguish of the man. Apparently this woman has got some complex gynecological problem, hopeless for the medicine of the day. She spent all of her resources trying to get help and has only got worse. What was in her mind when she thought that she would be helped by just touching Jesus' cloak? Well, we don't know. It could have been pretty close to superstition. It could have been that she'd heard reports about who this Jesus was, and she may have seen something of what he had done, or talked to people that had been helped by him, and so she thought, "If I can just touch his clothes, that will be enough." Or perhaps she was more sophisticated. Maybe she saw that he was so much more than just a representative of God, that just as God's altar in the tabernacle, according to Exodus 29, was so holy that if you simply touched it, you became holy as well. So maybe somehow she thought, "If I could just touch Jesus, something of who he is will rub off on me." What was going through her mind? We don't know because it's not disclosed. All we're told very simply is that she heard, she came, and she touched. The real measure of desperation, as there is with Jairus, and a real measure of faith. How informed her faith is, we don't know. But what we're told in verse 29 is that she experienced immediate healing. And then our central verse is verse 30. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone from him. He turned round in the crowd and he said, who touched my clothes? Now, the exact psychology of Jesus knowing that power had gone out from him is not easy for us to figure out. But Jesus knows that power has gone from him in order to transform. And he asks the question, who was it that touched my clothes? Now, it would be very unwise of us to assume that Jesus doesn't know the answer. We'll see that there are reasons in the text itself that suggest that Jesus knows exactly who it was. And in any case, there are many examples in the Bible where God certainly does know the answer to questions that he asks. For example, when Adam, after he rebelled in the garden, he hides, doesn't he? And God comes along walking as he normally does in the cool of the day. And what does he say? Adam, where are you? Does that mean God doesn't know? I'm looking for you, Adam. Where are you? Well, no, God knows, doesn't he? The point is that the question sometimes may be cast precisely to force an answer from the party to which the question is asked. God wants Adam to step forward and ultimately face his responsibility for what he has done. And we'll see in a moment that there is good reason for thinking that Jesus knows here. But in the meantime, the disciples can't make head or tail of what's going on. There's a crowd, and they're pummeling and pushing. You know, if you're a football crowd going into the stadium, and it's all a bit of a argy-bargy, trying to get jockeying for position. And people are here wanting to touch Jesus and squeeze him, give him a hug, and all of this is going on. And so in verse 31, it says, you see people crowding against you, his disciples answered, and yet you ask, who was it who touched me? And so the disciples somewhat ridicule Jesus. They say, how can you possibly ask such a stupid question? Who touched you? For crying out loud, everyone is touching you and bumping into you. Everyone wants to get a piece of you. Jesus doesn't back off. He persists in this quest. And in the following verses, you begin to see the significance of his question. Verse 32. But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. And then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Now, this has the effect of establishing what a true encounter with Jesus is like, as far as he is concerned. You see, over against the mass pressure of the crowd, with everybody touching him, somebody touched him who has taken something of Jesus's power. Over against those that merely are just wanting to draw close, merely trying to gain some sort of blessing, she wants the miracle from Jesus. But Jesus, this is interesting, Jesus wants a personal encounter. She would have been quite happy to have got the miracle and slipped away unnoticed and just go back into the crowd and get lost. So why doesn't Jesus say, well, that's another one healed. Thank you, Heavenly Father. And just press on through the crowd. After all, he's still got to get to Jairus' house. He's still got a young girl that needs to be healed. But instead, he slows the pace down. And the whole effect of this is to change something from just a mere power encounter into a personal encounter. You see, she wants a miracle, but Jesus wants a meeting. She wants answers to her problems, and he wants to confront her with respect to her faith. See, Martin Buber, who was a Jewish philosopher, distinguished between what he called I-it relationships and I-thou relationships. what he means. You see, I have an I-it relationship with my computer. I have an I-it relationship with my books. But I have an I-thou relationship with my wife and with my children and with you as the congregation. Now, some people want a kind of I-it relationship with God. God is the big power source of the universe. God is the supplier of whatever enables me to be able to do what I want to do. Or he is the one that gives me all of the blessings that I want. God is the genie in Aladdin's lamp that if I rub it, it will come out. Now, while God is the ground of all of our being, Christ won't let it sit there because he wants an I-thou relationship with us. That's why the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind and with all of your strength. It's a whole personal encounter with the whole personal sovereign creator God. And the question, who touched me, brings her forward. And trembling and in fear because she knows that she's been the recipient of something. And undoubtedly she's traumatized by these 12 years of being an outsider. And strictly speaking, she could have faced punishment for even being in the crowd at all. Because this woman was considered unclean by her constant bleeding. She was supposed to be kept away from her family. Anybody who came in contact with her was unclean until they'd gone through this ritual purification. And so, strictly speaking, anybody brushing up against her would have been considered unclean. The whole crowd would have been considered unclean. She shouldn't have been there. She knew she was in trouble. We've lived 12 years not only with this physical problem, but the shame and the loneliness. And now it was all going to be exposed in the light. Who touched me? Jesus said. Well, she comes forward and we're told in the text, she speaks the whole truth. Tells Jesus everything. In the kingdom of God, miracles are not an end in themselves. Miracles lead to a meeting with Jesus. They lead to a meeting with Jesus. It's not simply a matter of getting our needs met. It's growing in the presence of Jesus. It's being known by him and following him on his terms. Now, this woman does not evade him. In fact, she comes falling at his feet, trembling, and she is met with compassion, not reproach, from Jesus. Look again at verse 34. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be free from your suffering." And I think there are a number of things for us to notice from that verse. First of all, Jesus clearly knows her. He knows about her condition. He doesn't say, "Well, all of this is rather startling. I didn't know any of this. Now you've told me the whole truth. Now I do." It's quite dramatic, isn't it? No, it sounds as if he called her forward precisely so she could articulate what her needs are, in a framework of knowing who she is, knowing that she has been healed, and knowing that she has now been freed from all of the suffering that she's been through. Secondly, I want you to notice that the words of Jesus are connected with his touch. If he had said nothing, she might have gone away and been inclined to think of the power of Jesus largely in magical terms. The real answer, if I'm going to get a miracle, it's got to touch a corner of his robe, all that's necessary, and then wow, bang, just like magic, I'm healed. But no, by insisting that he knows that power has gone out of him, by talking about her faith, by insisting that he give this pronouncement, "Your faith has healed you," the whole thing now becomes rather personal, which is dispelling any notion that God's power is just a cheap magic trick. Thirdly, here, her action was an act of faith, because doubtless there were other ill people that pressed in on Jesus in this vast crowd, people gathering around this miraculous preacher, this wonder worker. Undoubtedly, there were other people pressing in and were healed. They touched, But they were not transformed. So why was this one healed and not the others? It wasn't simply the touch. It wasn't simply a case of magic. It wasn't the case of, well, I've got this dreadful disease, and if I brush up against Jesus, then zap, I'm cured. That wasn't it. No, she's transformed because she approaches Jesus as an act of faith. And however well informed her faith was, or however mixed with superstition her faith may have been, she expects to be transformed by Jesus. And Jesus acknowledges that point. He says, your faith has healed you. And then lastly here, the language Jesus uses is literally pregnant with meaning. The NIV from which I've been reading says, your faith has healed you. But the literal translation from the Greek says, your faith has saved you. Has saved you. You see, the notion of salvation includes not only the physical transformation, which includes our healing, but it includes deliverance from sin and from the curse of death. And ultimately, it means the transformation of our bodies on the very last day in the new heaven and in the new earth. It's as if the healing of this woman physically is part of that bigger saving. And so Jesus actually says to her, your faith has saved you. And we can't understand that in some narrow sense that may simply be referring to her healing. There's more going on here. But in the light of what this whole book is telling us, the Gospel of Mark that we're working through, in light of the fact that this book brings Jesus to the cross, in the light of the fact that in just five chapters on, in chapter 10, Jesus says, I didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. In the light of the fact that not very much further on in chapter 14, we will discover that Jesus is instituting the new covenant in his blood with the bread and the wine that we're going to be taking in a few moments' time. But in the light of the context of the whole gospel, it's not hard to see that this saving is more than just healing. The healing is a window into the larger healing that is taking place. It's part and parcel of Jesus' coming. And so that little phrase that he says, go in peace, has enormous significance, because what he's talking about there is the very shalom of God. It's not just a simple greeting, you know, peace be with you. It suggests much more than that. It's suggesting that there is peace with God and there is peace among human beings. That there is a right covenant relationship that is being forged. It's meaning much more than just go away and be happy. Now, all of that's not spelled out yet because we're still one side of the cross. But the language is pregnant with anticipation. And we get a better view because we're this side of the cross. And we can look back and see what's happening. Then we come to the second slice in the sandwich. We've left the meat now in the middle. And we come back to Jairus, verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, they said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. So it transpires that the delay with this woman with the hemorrhage has allowed time for Jairus' daughter to die. The healing of one meant the death of the other. And all of the people tell Jairus, that don't bother him anymore. He may be a healer, but resuscitation from death, I mean, that's a bit beyond it. Now, Jesus' response still focuses on the issue of faith. In verse 36, it says, overhearing, or the original says, ignoring what they said, Jesus told him, don't be afraid, just. And Jairus at least had enough faith, enough desperation to proceed. And isn't that part of the challenge of discipleship? When circumstances come along that seem sufficiently dire to us, it's easy for us to disbelieve, isn't it? It's easy for us to give up hope. The challenge of discipleship is to trust Jesus even when we experience loss, even when things are not going exactly how we want them to be, even when we're in the middle of the most horrific suffering or disappointment or grief. Jesus says to us, don't be afraid. Just believe. Just believe. He's still saying that to all that will follow him. Just trust. Apparently then, Jairus has some faltering faith here that needs to be propped up. And Jesus continues on his way, and as is not uncommon, he takes the 3 of the 12 disciples that constitute that inner core group, Peter, James and John, and they go into the house. And then we're given a vision of what first century mourning rites look like. Verse 38, when they came into the house of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and he said to them, what's all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. Now, of course, different cultures around the world have different mourning practices. For many of us in this country, we're supposed to keep a stiff upper lip to allow any emotion come on us at a funeral. But on the other hand, there are parts of the world where you're not honouring the person that has died unless you're letting all your emotions out. And first century Palestinian life, much closer to that. It was prescribed in some Jewish codes that even the poorest of families at a funeral were supposed to at least provide 2 professional wailing women and a flutist. And the flutist wouldn't be playing happy ditties, he would be playing some rather mournful dirges. And then the wailing would start. And the idea was if they could cry loudly enough and longly enough, then everybody else who was there would be desperate and start crying too and just join in the whole emotion of the event. That's the way it went. Professional wailers and mourners. But at a really large funeral where the family was wealthy, you'd have a really large wake. You'd have almost an orchestra of dirges and wailing women around. It could be very depressing. But on the other hand, all of the grief was being let out. There was a certain kind of catharsis that was taking place. It was considered part of the way you honoured the person that had died. And this is what Jesus comes into. The wailing started from the moment that this little girl had died, and it would continue until they were buried. And the burial would usually take place on the same day. That's the way that it operated. And so this little girl had died. The mourning had already started and the people were wailing and crying loudly. And Jesus said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? She's not dead, she's asleep. Now that's not a medical judgment by Jesus. It's a way of speaking of genuine death. And he said something similar, actually, about Lazarus. Even after Lazarus had been in the tomb for 4 days, and there was decay, and there was smell emanating, Jesus says, no, he's sleeping. And it's Jesus' way of saying that death is not final. Death may be the last enemy, but it doesn't have the last word. It's not final. And the disciples thought that this was pretty strange, too, because they didn't understand any of this. And so what we get here is even more scorn in verse 40. But they laughed at him. What do you mean sleeping? Probably the same people doing the professional wailing. And after he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him. And he went in where the child was and he took her by the hand. And he said to her, Talitha kum, which means little girl. I say to you, get up. And Talitha is a term a little bit like lambkin or munchkin. Which child? Get up. Jesus is speaking in Aramaic, but because Mark is writing for a Greek audience, he needs to translate the term, which is what he did. Little girl, I say to you, get up. Verse 42, immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. And here's Mark's little aside. In brackets, that there's a point to it. He was 12 years old. Same number of years as the woman. And at this, they were completely astonished. And he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. So that's the narrative. Do people faith? Now let's have a look at the same sandwich account in another way. Let's now consider two kinds of faith that are here. It's two people of faith, both Jairus and the woman. Let's have a look at the two kinds of faith. Who are the two people that exercise faith in this rather long account in Mark's Gospel? Well, we've got Jairus on the one hand, and we've got the woman with the hemorrhage on the other. And I just want us to notice the contrast between the two. Because Jairus is named. We notice that in the account, but we don't know the woman's name. It wasn't preserved for us. Jairus was a man of standing in the community. He was important. But not only did this woman not have any standing, such as a synagogue ruler would have, with this particular problem, she was a castaway. She was disgraced. She had lived the last 12 years of her life in shame. Jairus was appealing for someone else, for his daughter, but she was appealing for herself. He approaches Jesus respectfully without any pomposity. He falls at his feet, but from the front. She sneaks up behind, hoping to do no more than simply touch his robe. And when you read the account of Jairus, and although he's desperate, he has a kind of bold persistence. Come with me. My daughter is at the point of death. You can fix it, Jesus. But when you read the account of the woman, and she strikes us as desperate, but she's frightened, and she's ashamed, and she's utterly lacking in any confidence, and yet incredibly, at the end of the day, she has the faith that Jesus commends. You notice that? Daughter, your faith has healed you. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. But Jairus, for his part, his rather faltering faith has to be propped up. Don't be afraid. Just believe. And so it's precisely the sandwiched account of the woman that acts as a foil for the larger account in which it's been embedded. And as a result, we can understand faith much more clearly than if Mark had decided to separate those accounts and put them at different parts in his gospel message. Now, do we see what the bearing of all of this is for us? Let's begin for a moment what faith means on the streets of London outside here. If you would go and speak to somebody at random, ask them the question, what does the word faith mean to you? I wonder what people would say. What do you think they might say? See, unless you came across a Christian, I suspect that faith, for the overwhelming majority of people in London, means one of two things. First, it's a way of referring to different religions. There are many faiths, which is just another way of saying there are many religions. Now, that usage of the word is almost found in the New Testament. For example, Jude can refer to the faith that was once and for all delivered to the saints. But even there in the New Testament, when faith, the word faith, is used in that way, it's never used to refer to other religions. It's only used to refer to the Christian religion. Outside of that, it's far more common for the New Testament writers to think of idolatries rather than faiths. But second, and even more common in our culture, is that faith means personal religious preference that is totally abstracted from questions of truth. So some people are helped by their faith in Jesus, but some people are helped by their faith in Allah. Some people are helped by their faith in Krishna. And some people are helped by their faith in the vibrations of crystals. If it's true for you, that's all that really matters. The truth question, in an objective sense, is not on the table for discussion. Because you can't know truth in any of these things, in a true sense. It's a matter of personal faith. It's a matter of your personal religious preference. You have your faith, I have my faith. And who's to say you're right and I'm wrong, or you're right and he's wrong? Who's to say that? We can't say that. And it doesn't matter anyway, as long as you're sincere in what you believe. See, that's the way faith is used in our culture today. That's how people on the streets of London will see the word faith. Now, in the Bible, the validity of faith, in the first instance, is on the truthfulness of what is believed. It's quite the opposite. It turns on the truthfulness of the object of faith. So, for example, when Paul is talking about faith in the resurrection of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15, this is what he says. If it is not true that Jesus rose from the dead, then your faith is in vain. It's not vain because you've got a lack of sincerity. It's vain if Jesus didn't really rise from the dead, then you're believing in something that's not true. And he says, if it's only for this life that we have faith in Jesus, then we are, of all people, to be pitied. Because we're believing something that's not true. And worse than that, he says, well, the apostles that claimed that they saw Jesus risen from the dead were liars. And worse than that, we are sinners because we're still dead in our sins. We are, of all people, to be pitied because the form of religion that we have is not true. And so in the New Testament, faith is the God-given ability to perceive certain things that are true and to trust your whole life to them and to him who establishes their truthfulness. See, the Bible never ever suggests that we should believe or trust in something that is not true. That's not faith. That's stupidity. That's gullibility. Not faith. See, that's why the New Testament writers were always pushing the truthfulness of who Jesus was, or the fact of the resurrection, or the truthfulness of the eyewitnesses. They repeatedly say, we saw this. We are witnesses of this. This is part and parcel of the fact that this is historical revelation. God has revealed himself in real space, time, history. That's why the role of the witness is so important in the pages of the New Testament. There were people who saw and who touched and who heard and who wrote down and preserved and passed on. There are multiple attestations, multiple voices, multiple witnesses. And so it's very important to understand that New Testament faith has its ultimate validity in the truthfulness of what is believed. Now, nevertheless, having said that, it's also important to say that the New Testament writers give us additional flavours to faith in their different writings. And here, for example, is the faith of this woman that is cast most positively in the narrative, not the faith of Jairus. And it's that contrast that gives us a fresh insight into what Christian faith is all about. It's not only faith in Jesus, who is really true, who is really reliable, who is really trustworthy, but there's something more going on here. See, when compared to this woman, when we're comparing here Jairus and this woman, what did we see about her? Well, she has no name, no standing, and no security. She was ashamed. She did not deign to approach Jesus boldly. She came and was frightened. And I'm sure there are people here today who look around and maybe see other mature Christians. People maybe have been around the block a few times and may think, well, they're steady and they're stable. And maybe they're thought of as mature men and women of faith. And maybe you might look at your own life with all of the issues and the difficulties and the brokenness, and maybe feel, well, how can I really trust Christ? How can I really have faith in Christ? Maybe you've suffered enormously. And with suffering comes doubt. and fear and insecurity. Maybe you're just plain frightened of the future. How do I trust Christ? You know, there are many in our church that have been diagnosed with a serious illness. There are some that have been recently bereaved. Others know that they have got deep-seated sins in their lives that nobody else knows about except God Himself. And they're thinking, how can I trust Christ with all of this going on in my life? Well, I want to tell you this from this story. And that is, if a broken, disgraced, fearful, frightened woman in the first century has her faith commended by Jesus, then you, whatever is going on in your life, are welcome to come and to trust Jesus. That faith that is commended here in this double account is the faith that is not only desperate but broken. Not the faith of the strong, it's the faith of the weak. It's not the faith of the respected one, but the faith of the one that's disgraced. It's not the faith of the one that's bold, but it's the faith of the frightened. Because ultimately, it's who it is we've got faith in that counts. And the one that we have faith in is Jesus, the one with all of the power in the universe. This is bound up in the object of faith, which is Jesus Himself. And Jesus came as a doctor for the sick. He came as the one who is strong for the weak. He came for the broken and the bruised and the guilty. He was the one that said, look, those that are well don't need a physician. I come for those that need this help. And you know what? He doesn't want only that you should draw from His power to receive His healing, to receive His forgiveness and His salvation, and then just move on quietly, a crowd, and disappear. That's not what He wants. As you bow before Him, and as you trust Him, and you cry towards heaven, Lord, I do believe, but help my unbelief, you'll still hear His same voice saying, who was that who touched me? And He asks that question not because He doesn't know the answer, but because He wants an I-thou relationship with you. God's own Messiah, God's own agent in creation, God's own King of the universe wants to know you personally. He wants to forgive and empower the broken and the bruised and the needy and the frightened and the desperate. Above all else, He wants a relationship. That is really good news.